And good evening. Hope you had a good Labor Day weekend. Certainly a much deserved rest for the entire country. The unofficial end of summer. That's what this weekend was. Unfortunately, it begins with a rise in the death toll after Hurricane Ida. In the Northeast, where President Biden will visit tomorrow, 52 people now reported dead across six states, most in New York and New Jersey. Stories of people trapped in apartments, others unable to hold on to loved ones. A trooper in Connecticut swept away after responding to a missing persons call. According to the mayor of one town outside New York City, the floods used to come every 20 to 25 years, he said. Now they're coming every 3, 4, and 5 years, he said. In a moment, we'll have a live report from Louisiana as well. First, Athena Jones joins us with the latest from New York City. So what's going on?
Well, Anderson, we are in Queens, one of the areas hardest hit by the storm in New York City, both in terms of damage, as you can see from the debris piled up behind me, all up and down this block. People are clearing out, cleaning up, putting out appliances and furniture to try to begin to rebuild their lives. So hard hit with damages, but also with loss of life. Many of the deaths in Queens occurring in flooded basement apartments.
Heartbreaking stories of loss. New York police sharing video of their attempts to rescue a Queens couple and their two-year-old, all three later found dead in their flooded basement apartment. Two other Queens residents died when a wall in their home collapsed in the flooding. New York officials and FEMA's administrator touring storm damage in hard-hit Queens Monday.
What we saw today was absolutely heartbreaking, the amount of damage and destruction that these families have experienced.
Communities across the region beginning to put their lives and homes back together after the devastation wrought by the remnants of Hurricane Ida.
If you drive around Queens, it looks like a bomb went off. Everybody's personal belongings are out on the street. We just need someone to help us out.
State and federal officials say help is on the way, with President Biden set to visit New York and New Jersey Tuesday after approving federal disaster relief for five New York counties and six in New Jersey to help families and businesses repair and rebuild.
We're at least $50 million in damages, and we anticipate the numbers to go up, but that did trigger the threshold that we are eligible to apply for a major declaration assistance.
The true extent of the storm's impact is still being realized. Ida claiming the lives of at least 50 people across the region. At least four died in Pennsylvania, and at least 27 people lost their lives in New Jersey, where Governor Phil Murphy toured flood damage, telling reporters he plans to ask the president to provide federal disaster relief to more counties.
There were 15 other counties in New Jersey, and we're in there fighting on behalf of any of those other counties that were impacted.
State and local officials now focused on how to be better prepared for the next storm by improving infrastructure and putting better warning systems in place to alert people of the danger.
We have seawalls that need to be raised. We have sewers that were built 100 years ago. We really need help from the federal government to get back on our feet and get ready for the future, because we can't abandon communities like Mamaroneck, New York.
So, Athena, how do people who need storm relief get it from the federal government?
Well, one way, Anderson, is that the city, New York Mayor Bill de Blasio, is saying today that the city will be sending teams door to door to people's homes in all of the storm affected areas to make sure they're aware of these benefits and that they sign up to get this relief. We're talking about important relief from the federal government, like grants for temporary housing, for home repairs. So valuable aid, and officials here want to make sure everyone who should get it can get it.
Anderson. Athena Jones, I appreciate it. Thanks so much. The president's visit to the New York metro area tomorrow follows one he made last week to Louisiana, where this moment close to 500,000 people are still without power and where the intense heat after the storm has claimed even more lives among the state's seniors. Martin Savage is in New Orleans with the latest there. So what more do we know about what was discovered in New Orleans over the weekend?
Yeah, this is sort of the tragedy that came after the storm. And it began on Friday when members of the city health department for New Orleans began investigating a number of buildings that they knew were senior living facilities. And so once they got into the very first building, they said they found deplorable conditions. Clearly, the buildings were obviously without electricity. People were without air conditioning. The temperatures had soared inside of the building, and many of the seniors inside were trapped because the elevators didn't work, and they couldn't use the stairs to even get down to the ground floor. All weekend long, they continued to look at building after building after building that was for housing the elderly. All told, they found 10, which they've now shut down, evacuated hundreds of senior citizens to shelters to the north of Louisiana. And sadly, they also found five people who died. And they say that in some cases, these buildings did have a staff, but the staff self-evacuated, leaving the city senior citizens all on their own, Anderson.
What's the mayor said about this?
Yeah, Mayor Cantrell was really upset about this today. She was fired up at her press conference, and here's more of what she said about it.
And when you leave, nothing but a sign that says call 311, when they're responsible, I have a problem with that. So we're not going to get into a blame game scenario. We're going to call it what it is. And it was negligence, and it is not on the backs of the city of New Orleans.
Well, in fact, there is some pushback against the city of New Orleans, and it's coming from some of the owners of the buildings. In fact, the New Orleans Archdiocese, the Catholic Church, owns a couple of those buildings. And they say they reached out to the city before Friday and said the city should have known there was a problem. In fact, they said in the days following Sunday's landfall, Christopher Holmes' leadership repeatedly requested assistance and resources from civil authorities. The city, after the death of one of our residents was reported 5 days later on Friday, September 3rd, civil authorities finally responded and provided resources to evacuate those residents who had not voluntarily evacuated. In other words, why did the city wait until Friday, when the storm had hit on Sunday, to suddenly say we should investigate the welfare of senior citizens? Mm. They say they don't want a blame game, but it's in full force here tonight. Anderson.
And how are things in New Orleans and the rest of Louisiana?
Well, if you're talking about the city of New Orleans, they're getting better. 70% of the electricity by this evening is expected to be restored, and they hope to have most of the power back by Wednesday. But elsewhere, still about 500,000 people without electricity. And in many of the sort of rural or more distant parishes, it's going to be problematic because where the power lines have come down, it's so remote, they're going to need boats or airboats just to get in and try to find those systems. So that's why they're saying not till the end of the month for power for them. There are grocery stores, more of them, that open today. More gas stations open that have gasoline. The hospitals are up and running. And the National Guard is handing out food, water, and ice. So it's improving, but there's still a lot of suffering going around.
Yeah. Barton Savage, appreciate it. Thank you. I want to get perspective now on the destruction of Ida in the Northeast, as well as the president's visit from Eric Adams, the Brooklyn Borough president, who's now the Democratic nominee for mayor of New York City. Mr. Adams, thanks so much for being with us. This morning, you drew a comparison between President Carter's visit to the South Bronx in the 1970s, which brought a lot of global attention to the plight of the city, to President Biden's visit to Queens tomorrow. You think it's that significant?
Yes, I do. When you look at the 13 lives that were lost here, and the devastation of not only personal injury, but property damage, it is really going to highlight how our inner cities must start looking at how we deal with climate change.
Most of the deaths in New York City happened in converted basement apartments, illegally converted basement apartments that flooded. People were trapped, drowning in their own homes. How do you stop that if you're mayor?
Well, first, we lost lives also in vehicles. And as we deal with addressing the basement apartments, we also have a housing crisis. And it's predicted that about 100,000 people are living in basement apartments, and many of them are low-income New Yorkers. So we don't want to create one crisis or stop one crisis and create another. We need to be smart about this with early warning systems. We need to legalize some of the apartments. And then we need to transition people into permanent housing. But we have to be smart about addressing this real issue that we are facing, dealing with our climate and the weather, and then the climate around affordable housing and living standards.
Do you think this city and, I mean, other American cities are prepared for what potentially lies ahead as the climate continues to change?
No, we're not. And we have to be honest with ourselves. And I say this over and over, Anderson. Listen, we screwed up our planet. And let's be honest about that. And we have to be prepared for the future. We look at our sewer systems here in New York. Many of them made out of bricks. We're prepared to handle the rain. Or when you see something like that, we're ready for the rainfall. We're just not ready for Niagara Falls. I was out that night, and I saw the level of rain in our city that was just really something that was unbelievable to witness. And so what must we do? Let's be honest. Let's look at what other countries have done across this globe, like the Netherlands and others, and say, how do we live with water? We thought we could just build walls around our seashores and our water areas where high water are located. But that's not the reality. This came from inland. This came from the sky. And I think we just need to rethink about living with water and how we do it correctly. And then get immediate help. I was happy that the governor decided to deploy the National Guards to help in the cleanup effort. And then we're going to do some new things about early warning systems, using technology and any other method of letting everyday New Yorkers know when a storm is coming.
It's obviously the last thing this city needs, New York City. I mean, given the economic issues, public safety issues, I got to say for, you know, you and I have often discussed problems with police departments in this city and across the country. You were a captain in the New York City. I believe you're retired as a captain in the New York City Police Department. I got to say, to watch these videos where the police officers out during the storm diving underwater, trying to get people. I mean, it's just one of those, moments where you're very thankful for the folks who are out there, the police who are out there, the fire, firefighters as well.
Right. And we should never mix up the two. The call for proper police reform has nothing to do with our real admiration for the men and women who put on that blue uniform and put themselves in harm's way all the time. I believe that we have one of the most amazing law enforcement entities on the globe, if not the entire country. And I'm proud of what they do. Anytime there's an emergency, they place themselves in harm's way. And we don't have to mix up the justice we deserve with the safety we need. And the police department did an amazing job, as well as our first responders and our firefighters, in saving the lives of a large number of New Yorkers.
Eric Adams, I appreciate your time tonight. Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.
All right, you too. Still to come tonight, a story we warn you now is just horrific. A former Marine sharpshooter charged now with the murders of four individuals in Florida, including a baby, showed up killing people allegedly in two homes early in the morning, had no connection directly with the people he killed. It is a stunning story. We'll have that for you next. And later, two incredible stories of two groups of people escaping Afghanistan and the Taliban. Details when we come back. The tragic story out of Florida tonight. A former Marine sharpshooter who served in both Afghanistan and Iraq appeared in court today after being charged with four counts of first-degree murder, including the death of a baby. No plea entered yet. However, the judge ordered the man to remain in jail without bail. He's no attorney. He said he plans to hire one. In the meantime, he's going to be represented by a public defender. Randy Kay joins us from Florida with the latest. So investigators, are they still on the scene, Randy?
They are, Anderson. They are still processing the scene. They've been doing that now for a couple of days or so. You can probably see the Polk County Sheriff's forensic lab trailer behind me there. And then over my right shoulder here is that burned out pickup truck. That was on fire, actually, when the deputies arrived. They said that the suspect apparently caused that fire. Also, there's a path here from the street leading up to the house here behind me. The suspect had put some glow sticks there, trying to entice the deputies as they arrived to actually enter the home, just trying to pique their curiosity, apparently. But the sheriff here has said that this suspect was prepared for Armageddon, so that's why they have so much to process here. They said that there were three guns inside, so they're going to look very closely at those and process those. There were bullet holes all over the house and the doors and the windows. They're processing those. Also, plenty of blood was left behind at this horrific scene. And we are getting more and more details about this, Anderson. And I just want to warn you that some of those details you may find disturbing.
He's evil in the flesh. He was a rabid animal.
Polk County Sheriff Grady Judd is talking about a 33-year-old ex-Marine who is now charged with killing four people in a horrific pre-dawn shooting.
It was just, it's continuous, pop, 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 pop.
It happened about 4:30 in the morning Sunday at this house in Lakeland, Florida.
In the main house,
we discovered a man, a woman, and an infant in the mother's arms all shot to death.
Authorities say the baby boy was just 3 months old. Also dead, the baby's 62-year-old grandmother, who was hiding in her closet in another house on the property. The family dog also shot and killed. When deputies arrived, there was a shootout involving dozens, maybe even hundreds of rounds, says the sheriff. Windows and doors were left riddled with bullet holes, and deputies heard a woman scream and a baby whimper.
He was a coward.
Investigators say the suspect was wearing body armor, but surrendered after he was shot.
It would have been nice if he'd come out with a gun and then we'd have been able to read a newspaper through him. But when someone chooses to give up, we take them into custody peacefully. If he'd given us the opportunity, we'd have shot him up a lot. You see, it's easy to shoot innocent children and babies and people in the middle of the night when you got the gun and they don't. But he was not much of a man.
When deputies finally got inside, they discovered the bloody scene, along with an 11-year-old girl who had been shot multiple times but is expected to recover. Investigators say it does not appear the shooter knew his victims.
That's the scary part for me, because since it was random, I'm literally the next driveway, and it could have been me, you know, or my family.
The suspect now faces 4 charges of murder, as well as other charges, including attempted murder. The sheriff says the suspect told them he was a survivalist and high on meth, and this terrifying detail.
He just explained that they begged for their life and that he shot and killed them anyway.
The suspect served in Iraq and Afghanistan and was a designated sharpshooter. His girlfriend told investigators the suspect recently started to believe he was communicating with God.
She said he had PTSD. I've seen him depressed. And he said, you know, God spoke to him, and now he can talk directly to God. And she said, I'd never seen that kind of behavior.
According to the criminal affidavit, the suspect told authorities voices and God told him to do it. He allegedly said he shot the infant because I'm a sick guy, adding, I want to confess all of it and be sent to jail.
And Randy, you and I were talking about the other show, Full Circle, earlier. He actually showed up at this property hours before the shooting and then came back.
Absolutely, Anderson. 9 hours before, in fact, this really all started on Saturday night when the suspect, according to the sheriff, came by here. He was talking to the man out front, who now it turns out is one of the victims. He was mowing his lawn, and the suspect apparently said to him, according to the sheriff, that he was looking for a girl named Amber, saying that it was his daughter. And the suspect was apparently saying he had a message for her. He had been communicating directly with God and had a message for her. Well, the man said, there is nobody here by that name. You have to go. And then somebody else came outside from the house. Now we know that person is also a victim in this case, came outside and said to the suspect, you have to go. I'm going to call police. Nobody here by that name. And he said that he is communicating with God. They told him they didn't believe him. He left apparently quite angry about that and went home, drove about 45 minutes away to his home, Anderson, and somehow found his way back here at 4:30 in the morning on Sunday, high on meth, according to authorities, and shot the people that he had the altercation with on the front lawn and the others who were inside, Anderson.
And the 11-year-old girl, she was shot multiple times. She survived. Do we know how she's doing?
Yeah, she's doing well. She's going to recover, according to the sheriff. She was shot actually 7 times in her legs. It was really incredible that she survived this. It's a wonder she survived this. But the sheriff says that he spoke with her aunt, and apparently she told him that this girl had prayed and played dead, and that is how she managed to survive this, Anderson.
Randy Kay, I appreciate it. Thanks. As I mentioned to Randy, I spoke with the sheriff there today on my online show, Full Circle. It's an amazing and frankly chilling conversation. You can check it out at cnn.com/fullcircle. Next up, there's breaking news. The remarkable story of how a Texas woman and her 3 children escaped from Afghanistan by traveling overland, how they managed to get to safety. That story coming up. We're learning tonight about a remarkable escape from the Taliban, one of an American woman and her 3 children who got out of Afghanistan via an overland route. after not being able to fly out. Tonight, reportedly, they are safe. CNN's Alex Marquardt now with details. So what happened?
Well, Anderson, this information is from the Oklahoma Congressman Mark Wayne Mullen, who says that these four Americans who the State Department announced earlier today, who made their way out of Afghanistan overland, as you mentioned, are in fact three children and their mother. Now, he spoke with our colleague Brianna Keeler earlier today. He says that this family was not able to get out at the airport amid those scenes of chaos that we remember. They were not able to fly out from there. They were not able to fly out from another location in Afghanistan. So they made their way out of the country essentially on foot via that overland route. Now, we did ask the State Department about this earlier today. They didn't offer much in the way of confirmation. I want to read you part of their statement to us. They said, "We provided guidance to them, worked to facilitate their safe passage, and embassy officials greeted the Americans once they had crossed the border. In order to protect their privacy and preserve the viability of our tactics, we're not in a position to offer additional information." Anderson, these are just four of the estimated 100 Americans who want to leave the country since the full U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan.
Traveling overland, though, through to, I guess, to Pakistan, there's got to be a lot of Taliban checkpoints along the way.
This is a huge test of that assurance that the Taliban has given the U.S. and other countries, that they will allow people out of the country if they've got the requisite travel documents. What this family told Congressman Mullen is that on that journey, this harrowing journey, they had to go through more than 20 different Taliban checkpoints. And at one near that near the border crossing where they crossed out of Afghanistan, they had to wait for more than 13 hours. Now, the State Department has said that the Taliban was aware of this evacuation and did not impede that process. That is absolutely critical. This assurance is critical because so much of these people getting out hinges on what the Taliban does. Anderson, we've also been following another group of people trying to get away from Afghanistan and come to the U.S. They are Afghans who worked very closely with U.S. forces, Afghan pilots, members of the Afghan Air Force. And in order to prevent their equipment from falling into Taliban hands, they fought until the last moment and then literally flew their aircraft out of the country. Many of them are now trying to get to the U.S., and they are discovering how hard that is. As the Taliban swept across Afghanistan and closed in on Kabul, an order went out from the head of the Afghan Air Force to pilots: get in your aircraft and get out of the country. The pilots, many of whom were trained by the United States, took dozens of planes and helicopters, flying north to safety in Tajikistan and Uzbekistan. But now they're stuck, too scared to go back, unable, for now, to get to the U.S.
We're living here as like a prisoner, I can say that clearly.
I spoke today with a U.S.-trained pilot in Uzbekistan, held in a camp, whose plane was shot down by the Taliban in Afghanistan as he fled. He was rescued by an Afghan helicopter pilot and flown across the border.
My aircraft got shot, and so I returned back for landing. The aircraft crashed, but that was kind of like a forced landing. My back got injured a little bit. That's why I'm in the hospital.
The pilot is a colonel we are not naming for security reasons. He says he is one of over 460 pilots, mechanics, and others in Uzbekistan. He tells me he hasn't heard from U.S. officials about what will happen next, and many of their families are still in Afghanistan trying to get out.
There's rarely a day that goes by that there's not either an Afghan Air Force member or an immediate family member that either is detained or killed by the Taliban.
Retired General David Hicks was in charge of training Afghan pilots in the United States and is now working as part of a large network called Operation Sacred Promise, trying to get them to the U.S.
It's all volunteers, former servicemen, some civilians that are actually joined the team, and then there's some that are still active duty, and they're doing all of this on their personal time, trying to get these folks out. And it's been a roller coaster ride for the last 3 weeks.
Hicks says he's also in touch with the U.S.-trained pilots in Tajikistan, where he's told there are over 140 Afghan personnel and 13 aircraft. For help, Hicks reached out to lawmakers in Congress, including Representative Austin Scott, whose Georgia district some of the pilots trained in.
People understand these are people that fought with the United States on our side of a two-decade war, and I'd like to see them allowed to come to the United States, fully vetted, come to the United States as people who fought with our troops to protect our troops and did the right thing that the United States asked them to do.
Scott says Uzbekistan wants the Afghans out of their country. Both he and General Hicks are critical of how slowly the State Department is moving.
They've known for 2 weeks and 3 weeks in each of those locations there's personnel there. And to my best of my knowledge, nothing has been done to move any of them.
Alex, what's the State Department saying about that?
Well, not very much, Anderson. They didn't respond to our request for comment. They did speak to Reuters saying that the U.S. government is working closely with the Uzbek government, that the Afghans and their equipment are secure. There is some evidence, Anderson, that this process is moving, or at least has started. Two sources familiar with this process are telling me that biometrics have been taken from at least some of the men. That is a first step in the vetting and processing before many of these visa applicants can make their way to the U.S. Anderson.
Alex Marquardt, thanks very much. I also want to correct myself. I misspoke. I said earlier about that family of four who crossed over out of Afghanistan overland. I said I assumed it was to Pakistan. I shouldn't have made that assumption because there's obviously a number of countries it could have been, and the U.S. government's not saying. Up next, the battle over mask wearing and more in America's schools, with more students heading back to the classroom this week.
Fists are flying.
A summer that started with high hopes due to the COVID vaccines is ending with a surge in COVID cases and deaths. There are four times the number of people in the hospital with COVID-19 now compared to Memorial Day. Average new cases, daily cases up over 800%. Back then, we were losing an average of 594 people a day, now 1,561. Now, with that as a backdrop, this week ahead, more students return to the classroom for new school year. And across the country, that means more debates over mask wearing and other things. CNN's Sunland Sarfati has more on the culture wars in America's schools.
Our children, our choice.
Our kids can't be vaccinated. Mask up.
You hit me in the mouth. You don't hit me in the mouth.
You spit on me.
I didn't spit on you.
You did so. You had
you hit
mask
me in the
up.
Mouth.
These ugly scenes are happening outside schools and in school board meetings all over the country. Some school districts are now battlegrounds in the highly partisan culture wars. Issues like mask wearing, critical race theory, and gender equality have led to anger and threats from both sides. Protesters outside a school board meeting in Williamson County, Tennessee, erupted after the board voted for a temporary mask mandate in elementary schools.
We know who you
know
are.
Who you are.
We know who you are.
You can leave
we
freely,
know who you are.
But we will find you, and we know
you will
who you
never
are.
Be allowed in public again. You are.
The local police had to step in to control the crowd. This school board in Loudoun County, Virginia, were meeting on critical race theory and transgender students' rights. Critical race theory holds that much of America's history includes systemic racism. Teaching it has been restricted in at least 28 states, according to the New York Times and the nonprofit educational news outlet Chalkbeat. Attendees say the crowd here was so upset they screamed and threw things at board members.
You're teaching children to hate others because of their skin color, and you're forcing them to lie about other kids' gender. I am disgusted by your bigotry and your depravity. It's time to replace the radical.
One attendee was even arrested by police for allegedly threatening to hurt someone.
This is an unlawful arrest.
This San Diego County Board meeting on vaccines is just one more example of how children are being placed front and center in these debates.
Your children and your children's children will be subjugated. They will be asked, how many vaccines have you had? Have you been a good little Nazi?
Sunland Sarfati, CNN, Washington.
A lot going on in America's schools. Recently I talked about it with the Education Secretary, Miguel Cardona. Secretary Cardona, how do you cut through the noise to make sure that kids are not getting caught in the middle of these sort of culture wars going on in classrooms?
You know, we really need to focus on what's best for students. And at this point, we're talking about making sure students have an opportunity to be in the classroom safely and making sure our staff feel safe going to work so that we don't have another year of disrupted learning. Students suffered enough. It's time to make sure we do everything we need to do to focus on our students being in the classroom safely.
And you have two decades of experience as a public school educator. Have you ever seen a time in your career where political division in the country has seeped so far into the world of education? I mean, parents are getting into fistfights over mask mandates.
I really haven't, and it is unfortunate. We need to make sure we stay focused on getting our students back in the classroom safely, letting our educators teach, letting our school leaders do their jobs and our district leaders do their jobs. It is unfortunate to see what's happening, but you know, across the country, we're seeing also great examples of students coming back into school after a year of absence because educators and leaders are doing the right thing. So I'm really pleased with that, but we need to make sure across the country that all children have an opportunity to come in safely and not worry about catching COVID in school.
Should there be mandatory vaccinations for teachers?
You know, I support states when they're doing that. We don't vaccinate. We don't mandate vaccines or masks at the federal level. We just want to make sure that we're doing everything in our power to keep our students coming into the classroom safely. And I do support those places where they're requiring it. It passed FDA approval. We know it helps keep our children safe. So I do support it.
The Department of Education recently opened investigations into whether five states that ban mask mandates are discriminating against students with disabilities who might have a higher risk for severe illness, obviously, from COVID-19. And one of those states, Iowa's Governor Kim Reynolds, said that the Biden administration, quote, decided to pick a political fight and went on to say, quote, we will continue to support individual liberty over government mandates. Is that what this is about, individual liberty?
You know, I support the ability for local districts to make decisions on how to safely reopen schools. We really need to keep the politics out of it. We did this last year. I was a commissioner of a state last year, and we reopened schools by working well together, communicating regularly. We're prepared, the Department of Education, to work with every state, every governor, to do what we can to support their safe reopening. We've done a lot at the department in terms of handbooks and guidance. We really need to work together to keep our students safe, number one, and learning in the classroom. They've, as I said earlier, they've suffered enough. They've been disrupted. We can't let this year be another year of disruption. And I'll tell you, Anderson, in those places that are less likely to enforce the mitigation strategies that we know work, we're seeing sad stories of emergency rooms being filled up and ICUs being filled up. We could do better, and our students deserve that.
And just finally, I mean, what do you say to parents who say this is a matter of individual liberty and they don't want their kids being forced to wear a mask when going to school? They think it ruins the experience for their child in the school.
You know, I understand the emotions are strong on both sides, but disrupted learning or being forced to learn from home, this is worse. And children are fine. I was in a school earlier today. The children are fine. This is more than just that parent's child. This is about the child that sits next to that parent's child who might have a vulnerability, who might have a disability and is more likely to end up in the hospital if he or she catches COVID. So let's come together around our children. I mean, Their safety is the most important thing for us. So let's keep them safe. And as soon as we're able to remove the mask, believe me, I want them off too. But right now, it's not the time to take them off yet.
Secretary Cardona, I appreciate your time. Thanks.
Thank you.
Just ahead on this Labor Day Monday, the CNN Films LFG, airing in just a few minutes, profiling the U.S. women's national soccer team and why their biggest battle may be happening off the field. What the captain of the team told me next. On this Labor Day, there's a new CNN film airing in just a few minutes. It's called LFG, and it captures members of the U.S. women's national soccer team and their battle for equal pay. They've won 4 Olympic gold and 4 World Cup championships, and the players allege they're not receiving pay that's equal to what the men's team makes. A federal court disagreed last year, throwing out the players' equal pay claim. The judge found that the women's team negotiated a different pay structure than the men's team and that the women's players were already paid more than the men's team. The players are now appealing. Earlier, I talked with Becky Sauerbrunn, captain of the U.S. women's team. So, Becky, thanks so much for joining us. Talk about the thought process that you and your teammates went through about bringing this suit for equal pay.
Yeah, sure. So I've been on the team for a decade, and I've been through a few rounds of collective bargaining. And each time we were making some strides in working conditions and better pay, but it seemed like the gap in a lot of cases was still widening when it came to our male counterparts. And so we started to explore different avenues of how could we close the gap. And in 2016, we decided to file a complaint with the EEOC. And we were really excited about that. It was a huge move for us. And it was just going so slow. They had not come to any sort of judgment or result. And so we decided then in 2019 that we were going to withdraw the EEOC complaint and actually file a lawsuit. And so we kind of escalated pretty quickly.
The U.S. women's soccer team has been incredibly successful. 4 Olympic golds, as we mentioned, 4 World Cup championships, including obviously 2019. Was it a hard decision? I mean, to effectively decide to sue, I don't know if you're suing your boss, but to sue, I guess, your boss.
Yeah, very much suing your boss. And surprisingly, it wasn't that tough. Hmm. The program, the women's program, has been around for a few decades now. And really, it was time. It really was time. And so when we brought this to the team and kind of tried to explain what this would look like, how long it would take, the energy and the asks of effort from the players, everyone was on board. And it was really pretty astounding and astonishing. And it makes me really proud to think about, but we were like full steam ahead. Let's do this.
So a federal judge dismissed the equal pay claim of the U.S. Women's National Team lawsuit, which your team is now appealing. I'm wondering what your reaction was when you heard that news.
Oh, man. Very, very disheartening. I think we all kind of had a minute where we held the pity party and we were like, oh, this is terrible. How could they think that? And, you know, we disagreed with the judge's arguments. And then really it was, okay, what are our next steps? And I don't think anyone actually thought, okay, that's it. Let's just, you know, clap our hands and be done with all this. It was very much like, okay, how does this appeals process work? Do we need to bring on a new legal team? Just, you know, it was all like, okay, what's next? What's next? What's next? This fight is not over.
So, I mean, we should also point out that the judge ruled that the U.S. women's national team earned more both cumulatively and on an average per game basis than the men's team during years the lawsuit is suing over. Did his reasoning make sense to you?
Unfortunately, it did not make sense to us. What we're really arguing is about rate of pay. And so, unfortunately, we had to play about 30 more games and have to be very successful in all the games that we played in to even make a comparable wage to what the men had. So for us, it's not about the accumulative amount. It's actually about the rate of pay. And in that respect, there is discrimination.
And just to be clear, the prize money amounts for World Cup specifically, they're determined by International Soccer Association, not the U.S. Soccer. Is that right?
FIFA is responsible for the bonuses that get paid to each federation. And so if we win the World Cup, that money then goes to the federation and the federation decides how that's dispersed to the players.
And working condition, there's a working condition settlement that's been reached. Did that give any kind of, was that a forward step?
I think so, yes. I think working conditions are extremely important. And luckily we did come to a very nice settlement where we have equal working conditions to the men. I would say that was a long time coming. We are very, very happy that we got to that point. And now it is on to the equal pay and making sure that there's no more wage discrimination between us and our male counterparts.
I mean, just why were working conditions different between women and men? Just as an outside observer, that makes no sense.
Exactly. It made no sense to us either. So
when you say different, in what way were they different?
Well, we are basically a traveling circus. And so we have all this stuff that we have to schlep from one location to the next location to play. And for the most part, the men were getting better travel conditions. They were getting the charter flights and even their staffing was better and they were traveling with better equipment. And so it's all these things that really add up when you consider that our job is to travel the world playing soccer.
Yeah. And to someone listening to this, they think, well, you know, it sounds glamorous that you're traveling the world and you're complaining about how you're doing it. When you're traveling the world, I mean, as I can speak from experience, this stuff really matters, like how you get from point A to B when that is your entire life, when your entire life is spent in hotel rooms and getting from one place to another, you start to, you know, notice when other people are doing it in a way that's much easier for them and actually helps them play better probably. And you have to expend all this energy dealing with all this crap that no one else does.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, you hit the nail right on the head. It is a competitive advantage and it goes from travel to hotels to staffing of, you know, your medical staff. So it's kind of runs the gamut.
So you've said that what you're doing isn't about you and your teammates involved in this lawsuit. It's not only about that it's something much bigger. What is your message for young players, both men and women, boys and girls getting into the sport on the future of equal pay?
Yeah, I very much feel that there's 28 plaintiffs in this lawsuit. And for the most of us, for the most part, we will not be getting any sort of advantage from getting equal pay. We're going to phase out. We're going to get older. We're going to be done with playing soccer. So it's really about doing this for the next generation. And so I'm hoping that the young girls and the young guys out there that are getting into the sport, that they're not going to have to fight this fight, that it's already been fought, and that women will be valued just as much as their male counterparts. For the young guys and for the grown guys, be allies. You know, like if you see something, ask questions. Why is it run this way? You know, don't put your head in the sand. You know, we need allies and men fighting for us and fighting for women. That has a huge impact.
Becky Sauerbrunn, I appreciate talking to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Be sure to tune in. The new CNN film, LFG, profiling members of the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team, premieres in just a few minutes at the top of the hour right here on CNN.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.